Welcome to the Talk BD podcast. Today, we break down body clocks and bipolar disorder.
I feel like I'm in for such a treat today. It's my pleasure to introduce our panelists for the day, Dr. Holly Schwartz, professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh, newly minted president of the International Society of Bipolar Disorders. Welcome to Talk BD, Holly.
Thank you, Erin. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really excited and pleased to be here. This is such a great series, and I'm really honored to be part of it.
We're going to be talking all things body clocks and bipolar disorder, but honestly, one of the things I'm actually kind of really excited about is just kind of ironic because I'm actually doing it for the first time through a podcast. We've worked together for well over 2 years and lots of missy meetings and board meetings. And yeah, this is one of the first times I've had a chance to really get to know you a bit better as a person. And I'd love to hear a bit more about your origin story and what journey you went on to bring you to where you are as a professor of psychiatry, specializing in bipolar disorders today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know anybody whose journey is linear. And like everyone else in the world, you know, I never could have predicted when I started out where I ended up. I actually was going to be a marine biologist. That was my big plan. I'm a science nerd. I was always interested in science, in particular biology, but I was interested in the ocean and sort of how the ocean functioned and how invertebrates and vertebrates behaved in the ocean. And somehow after college, I took a job in a psychiatric hospital. Actually, I was a little bit unsure where I was going. And I really loved talking to people about their lives, their experiences, their struggles. And I was, you know, the science part of me was really curious to understand what was happening when people experienced difficulties and what could be done to help people thrive, recover, manage their struggles in a psychiatric setting. So I went to medical school knowing that I was going to be a psychiatrist.
Did you have the chance to work with people with bipolar disorder specifically at that point, that early point? Yeah.
Yeah. So the experiences of a woman sticks in my mind, and she, you know, she was really a very open and, you know, just lovely human being who struggled a lot. And I think the thing that struck me, because I was, you know, kind of working in this hospital, and she came in during manic episodes and she came in during depressive episodes. And I got to know her in very different mood states. And that was really interesting to me, to be able to talk to her about sort of how I experienced her during these different mood states. And also, her experience of being in the hospital in these different mood states was very different. And that was interesting. Like, how could people experience such really different mood states and yet be one whole and integrated person? So that also sticks in my mind for sure. So I was interested in bipolar disorder again from the very beginning, driven again by people who I talked to and who showed me the way, really.
So should we talk about the topic of the day?
Let's talk about the topic, yeah.
Yeah, body clocks and bipolar disorder and this idea of circadian rhythms. I always feel so smart when I talk about circadian rhythms because it's literally the only word I understand the Latin origins of, I think. Anyway, I think that circa in Latin means about. And dia means day. And so it's kind of, you know, relating to about a day. But give us the sort of, you know, 101 definition of circadian rhythms and why they're important in particular for people with bipolar disorder.
Well, I think it's first helpful to kind of step back and realize that circadian rhythms are patterned physiologic activities and behaviors that run on an approximately 24-hour schedule. So, for example, the sleep-wake cycle. They have a really big effect on how you feel and how well you function. Circadian rhythms are part of all life, not just mammals. Also, plants have circadian rhythms. All living things have circadian rhythms, and these are very adaptive biologic processes that allow living things to interact efficiently and effectively with the environment. So it allows us, you know, so if we think back to sort of our human ancestors, it allowed us to be active during the day when our most important food sources, so either gathering or hunting, were available and allowed us to sleep and be quiescent during periods where we would be out of harm's way to keep us safe and allow our bodies to recover. So the circadian rhythms allow us to live in harmony with our environment. They're biologic processes that are controlled essentially by a master clock in the brain. So the master clock is called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, right? So it sits kind of the front sort of middle part of your brain. And it's like a conductor. That's the way I think about it. Because there are also circadian pacemakers in every organ system in the body. So in your stomach, in your GI tract, in your muscles, you know, in your vasculature, it's in your skin. Mm. I mean, there's circadian pacemakers everywhere. And, you know, if you can think about yourself as like a great big sensor where our bodies are constantly sensing when we are in time. And all that information is being fed back up to this master pacemaker, and the master pacemaker in turn is sort of telling our bodies when to do things. And so this integrated system is really effective in helping us to live harmoniously in our environment. So to be alert when we need to be alert, to be hungry when it's adaptive, to be hungry, to be able to concentrate when we need most of our focus, to be, you know, sort of physically fit when we need to be doing physical activities. And so these things are programmed in our bodies and work quite well. Every person knows about circadian rhythms, even if you're not sort of consciously aware of it. You probably know, you know, more or less when you get sleepy and when you fall asleep. You probably know more or less when you are hungry. And this diagram here shows a typical pattern of circadian rhythms. Everybody's different, but this is kind of like the average, kind of shows what's happening in our bodies over the course of a 24-hour period. Typically, if we start in the early evening, an important hormone for sleep, melatonin, starts to rise in our brains. Again, this is being controlled by the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And that starts to put some of our body processes to sleep. So things that would be alerting start to shut down. Our concentration, our focus, our body temperature. So we can kind of, we're in a mini hibernation state. Our bowel habits, right? So we don't want to be running up and going to the bathroom all the time. That starts to shut down. So it gives us, our bodies, a protected period of time to recover. And that melatonin level stays high during the night. And then as morning approaches, cortisol, which is the alerting hormone, starts to go up. And then those other systems come online, all of which are under circadian control. So our blood pressure rises, our elimination systems come back online, and also our cognitive functioning. So we're more alert in the morning. And you'll notice that in this chart, we're most coordinated and our reaction times are best in the late afternoon, which is probably when our ancestors would have been out hunting game as dusk started to fall. And this system kind of repeats itself. And this is controlled by proteins and genes in our brain that loop back on one another to ramp up and ramp down depending on the inputs that we're getting from the outside. And again, the system works quite well. However, some of us have some different wiring internally that makes this circadian system a little bit more finicky. And, you know, there's some, again, evolutionary advantages to this. So if you think about, let's say, birds that migrate across multiple time zones, to have that circadian flexibility to be able to stay awake when they need to stay awake, to be able to feed when food is available, this actually confers some evolutionary advantages, right? Same thing with humans. There's probably some evolutionary advantages to having a flexible circadian clock so that perhaps our evolutionary ancestors could feed more flexibly, hunt more flexibly. But in today's world, having a finicky, more sensitive biologic clock is often at odds with the structured exterior world that we live in. And we know that individuals with bipolar disorder are more likely to have a biologic clock that's more sensitive to getting off track, less likely to kind of keep a very strict and steady rhythm. And this can cause mismatches between what the person is feeling inside and what the environment is telling them they should be feeling. I mean, you know, we can talk more about this, but the short answer would be you're awake when you're not supposed to be awake, or you're sleeping because you're tired, but everybody's telling you, wait, you got to get up, you got to go to school, you got to go to your job. And this kind of mismatch between what's happening in the outside world and what's happening in your circadian system is a really common issue that folks with bipolar disorder struggle with.
Interesting. And you said before as well that people differ in terms of their circadian rhythms, and it's not sort of a cookie cutter approach. Can you tell us a bit more about how that can show up differently for people?
Yeah. So, you know yourself, some of us are night owls, some of us are morning larks, morning people. That's called chronotype. And we think that this is highly heritable. So, you know, if you grew up in a household with other night owls, you probably inherited a tendency to be kind of a night owl yourself. There's nothing, this is normal. I mean, this is just sort of, you know, the range of human experiences. And we do think that folks with bipolar disorder have more of a night owl tendency in general, tend to be shifted a little bit more towards be more alert, active, and later at night, and have a little more trouble getting going in the morning. I think that's a really common chronotype. And again, if you can set your life up to work with that, great, you know. But if it starts to be at odds with what you need to do, then it starts to be a problem. And so if you have a late, you know, chronotype, an owl chronotype, but you have to get up really early in the morning to take your kids to school or to go to work, you know, you're fighting your biology, and it's hard.
And a lot of people will have had experience or know what it feels like to be out of sync or out of rhythm. If you're jet lagged, for example, or season changes would be another time. Even that 1 hour change in clock time sometimes, you know, most people will have experienced how discomforting it feels to be out of sync and out of rhythm, right?
Right. So the other piece about the circadian system, which I didn't mention, is that it's an open system, which means that we actually get a lot of information about like light in through our eyes back to the suprachiasmatic nucleus. Also, as I said, like when you eat, it sort of tells your body when it is. And so when you lose an hour for the time change, or we travel across time zones, it takes a while for your circadian clock to take in all that information and reset itself. So during that period of time, you're sort of brain lags behind the environment, and that kind of mismatch creates a lot of the symptoms that we actually associate with bipolar episodes. So you know, might have changes in your appetite, concentration might be off, you might feel kind of foggy, you might be more irritable. And these kinds of, you know, sort of common experiences with jet lag can get magnified when you have bipolar disorder, and can get worse. And if you have bipolar disorder, it's harder for your body clock to reset itself. And so it can, you know, if you go across time zones and this process gets going, it may be harder to reset.
Traveling across time zones and jet lags is a very sort of obvious big example of how rhythms can get disrupted in all of us, and exquisitely sometimes in people with bipolar disorder. But are there some more subtle ways that rhythms can get disrupted as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of us do things during the course of our lives that destabilize our rhythms. You might, you know, stay out late to go out with friends, and then you get to bed later than you're used to getting to bed, and then, you know, kind of messes with your sleep the next day, and you feel out of sorts. Or maybe, you know, you get sick and you have to go to the emergency room, you know, and you're up all night, or you have to take a loved one to the emergency room. Kid, a baby who's crying all night. I mean, there's lots of ways in which our lives are fighting with our circadian rhythms. And again, if you have bipolar disorder, it's much harder to get back on track again. Right. And so, you know, our circadian system is created to re-equilibrate. But if you've got a more finicky, sensitive system, it might not go as well as somebody who doesn't have that vulnerability. Mm.
We hear a lot as well about the effects of light later in the evenings, smartphone use in at night. Any thoughts on that piece?
Right. So that's another good example of the ways that we can inadvertently disrupt our circadian systems, right? So the light that helps us stay awake during the day is the blue spectrum of light in particular. And it's as it goes in through our eyes, it's basically telling our brains, hey, it's time to be awake, right? And as that starts to fade, as the sun sets, it's telling our body, ooh, it's getting close to bedtime. So time for you to come on board melatonin. And so the melatonin levels start to rise and then we prepare for sleep. But if we expose our brains to blue light during that period of time when we're supposed to be settling, it actually suppresses melatonin secretion. And so again, our bodies, this is an evolutionarily adaptive set of biologic processes. And it was kind of set up to make us go to sleep when the sun sets and get up when the sun rises. But with all of our devices, we're basically bathing our brains in blue light. And it's basically telling our circadian system, nope, still daytime, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake, stay awake. And so if we aren't careful about our devices as nighttime approaches, this is an alerting signal for our brains, and it can really interfere with our ability to get good quality sleep. And so a recommendation, especially if you have a sensitive body clock, is to really avoid blue light exposure in the evenings.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the take-home messages I'm getting now, though, is some of the things you're talking about are within our control, like light exposure, for example. Some of them aren't, you know, a visit to the emerge room. I'm just wondering if you have any tips for people about how they can kind of anticipate or manage or prevent or have a bit more control over some events that are likely to be disruptive to body clocks.
Yeah. So let me just back up for a second. So one thing, and some of the work that we've done over the years, this was all pioneered by Ellen Frank, who is an emerita professor at the University of Pittsburgh. She developed a kind of psychotherapy called interpersonal and social rhythm therapy. And we've also tested the social rhythm therapy part of it separately. And we have been able to show that if you have bipolar disorder and you're able to keep your routines more regular, it's associated with better outcomes. So more rapid recovery from mood episodes, less likelihood of having a new episode. So we believe, and the evidence supports the idea that having more regular routines is associated with better outcomes if you have bipolar disorder. And the routines can be both like physical routines, getting out, getting sunshine, eating, but also social routines. When you have contact with other people, when you go to work and do your usual social activities. So the idea would be, if you have bipolar disorder, you're likely to feel better if you can be more regular. But as you point out, there's stuff that gets in the way. And some of it is anticipated and some of it is unanticipated. And so I think there's some strategies that you can use in those two different scenarios. So if it's an anticipated disruption in your routine, you're going on vacation or you're having some house guests or you know that you're going to be, you know, moving around for work or something like that. What we typically recommend is trying to keep your routine as constant as possible or as consistent as possible with your usual routine at home. And if it's impossible to follow your old routines exactly, keep as many of them as possible in place. So try to, you know, eat at the time you're used to eating, take medications at the time you're used to taking medications. Exercise if you're able to at the time when you would normally exercise, and really be intentional about trying to stay on track, even though you're in a different setting, and also involve your people. You know, let them know, gosh, I really want to stay on this schedule. Can you help me? Can we have dinner a little earlier than we might want to have it, you know, given where we are right now, you know, and explain to them why this is really important to you. Frankly, it's probably important to everybody because everybody has a body clock and we all feel better. Whether we have a sensitive or not so sensitive body clock, we feel better when we're more regular. If an event is out of our control, you know, I think the first thing to do is not beat yourself up. It's like stuff happens, right? We're not, you know, this isn't anybody's fault. But the idea would be to try to get back onto your routine as soon as possible. So let's say you have a bad night of illness and you're in, you know, the emergency room. your inclination is going to be then to sleep all day, skip meals, not do anything, not see anybody, don't get any light because you're going to be in your room with the blinds closed. But in fact, probably the opposite is what you need to do, to kind of push yourself to get light exposure during the day so that you remind your brain when it is to eat when you would normally eat, so that your gastrointestinal tract can tell your brain when it is. I mean, you might need to take a little nap so that you can function, but try not to take it too late in the day so that you can go back to sleep at your regular time. So the idea here would be, you know, to give yourself a little grace if you can't do what you normally do, but try to get back on track as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. There's a lot of things jumping out at me. I remember sort of 25 years ago when I was first training in psychology and rhythms, you know, the messaging was that light was certainly the strongest, we would call it a Zeitgeber, a timekeeper. And then over the years, all of this really emerging and interesting evidence about how many other cues there are for us internally, physically, and in our environments that subtly help us stay on track, and how important it is to pay attention to those. And some of them are social, which is fascinating as well.
Yeah. I mean, so Zeitgebers or timekeepers are those inputs that keep our brains, you know, go like a metronome going on a steady pace with circadian rhythms. The geophysical inputs, so light, temperature, body position, those are extremely important inputs.
Sorry, body position?
Right. So we talked about, actually, there are sensors in our blood vessels, in our vasculature, that can sense whether we're vertical or horizontal. So one of the pieces of information that our body needs to start the day is that we're vertical. If we go back to bed and lie down.
My morning routine, I'm really good. It's like is getting light around 7:30 now. I get up, open the curtains, but then I lie back down in bed and look at the top of the trees through the window for the next 10 minutes. You're telling me I actually have to get up and get vertical to be most
efficient? I don't think anybody has to do anything, right? So if your system works for you and you're feeling good, you do you. But if you're having a little bit of trouble staying on track, if your sleep is out of sorts, try and get vertical and stay vertical. It gives more information to your brain, right? Eat something, because that gives some information to your brain. If you're, you know, like some people feel fine without doing any of this stuff, you know, great. But again, the idea here is, if you're more sensitive, if you're struggling a bit, especially with sleep and other routines, try some of this stuff because it gives your brain information. And getting back to the issue of social Zeitgeber. So again, this was work again that Ellen Frank did and Tracy Ellers and other colleagues. The idea is, we were talking about the fact that the circadian system is evolutionarily conserved. And it was created like when we were going to sleep when the sun set and got up when the sun rose. But most of us don't do that anymore. And so it's much more the social constraints of our lives that help to set and maintain our daily routines. And so in this post-industrial world, having contact with another person, taking care of, you know, your animals, your children, other people in your life, going to work, doing volunteer activities, going to the gym, exercising. These are all things that have an impact on our circadian system as well. And these are social factors which we have probably more control over in some respects than these geophysical Zeitgebers, which are kind of happening in the background. And so, you know, being really mindful and intentional about keeping these social factors regular is another thing that we can do to kind of help our circadian systems to stay on track.
So if you're going to walk your dog with a friend each day, try and do it around the same time, if possible. Something like that?
Something like that. And don't, you know, animals are great. because animals have circadian systems too, and they're going to wake you up at the same time every day.
They're going to tell you when it's dinner time for sure.
For sure. And that's a great Zeitgeber, right? Because you're not going to forget. They're not going to let you forget, right? And so, you know, animals are wonderful ways to help us stay regular for sure.
One of the other things I'm thinking about, I don't know if you've heard this clinically when you've worked with people with bipolar disorder over the years, is that, you know, what we're talking about, a lot of what we're talking about now is good self-management strategies for the condition. You know, thinking about exercise, sleep schedules, when we're eating, when we're having social contact. It sounds, you know, often we recommend, you know, self-management strategies, self-care. We know there's an evidence base in bipolar disorder to show that they are a very strong predictor of mood stability. But it almost sounds a little bit easy when we say self-management. And when I work with a lot of people with bipolar disorder, a lot of this stuff is really kind of hard and boring. And you know, it's hard sometimes to get up around the same time every day, especially on the weekends, and get vertical. And, you know, I don't know what your experiences have been, but often when I work with people, there's a bit of a cost-benefit analysis that goes along with this. It's like, is it worth it to put this amount of energy into all of these activities to stay stable? Because it takes a lot of work sometimes, right?
It does take a lot of work. On one hand, it's very empowering. I mean, I think self-management strategies tell us that we can take control of our lives. We can manage our bipolar disorder. And I think that that's important, wonderful, and empowering, but it is really hard work. In fact, I mean, we know that any kind of behavior change is hard for us as human beings, you know, to start an exercise regimen or stop smoking or lose weight. I mean, we really struggle to do that. And keeping a regular routine, you know, would fall under that umbrella as well. It's hard to do. It has, you know, really great payoffs. But, you know, I think generally some of the strategies that I've used to help people get to where they want to be clear that it's not all or nothing. There's sometimes some small things that people can do to get started, feel more manageable. I think having some kind of coach helps. Yeah. We all seem to do a little bit better when we have some degree of accountability. So whether that's a therapist or a loved one who's kind of willing to do that with you. If you can get the household involved with this, it's often easier. You know, if you want to have a healthy diet, you know, getting everybody that you cohabitate with to, you know, agree not to have tons of junk food in the house, that makes it easier, right? So I think, you know, enlisting social supports to make these changes and giving yourself permission to stumble again. I was talking about my own journey. No journey is linear. We all, you know, stumble, fall, but the good news is with resilience, we can get back on track again, get where we want to get.
That self-compassion piece and kindness to ourselves. Yeah. And also, you know, sometimes I think, you know, these activities may be more important if you feel like you're getting a bit wobbly and you know that you need to step up your attention onto self-management strategies. Other times, you know, they could be more in the background. So a lot of people will kind of be in flux in terms of, you know, how important they are. And part of that, I think, is about measuring mood and really having a, you know, a good sense of where your mood is at, where your wellness and quality of life is at. So you have that data in hand, and then you can kind of pre-arm yourself to know if something is slipping, that you might need to kind of ramp up your attention to self-management and self-care strategies.
Yeah, I agree. So this is the social rhythm metric. So this is what we use in our work to both monitor regularity of routines and mood. And you can see that there are specific items that we track: time out of bed, first contact with another person, time that you start your usual activities, dinner and time to bed. And then we have some people can personalize it. And then there's space for rating mood and energy level. And you can really look at that if you track it at the relationship between the regularity of your routines and your mood. And it's a good place to see what's happening and sort of the relationship between them. And as you said, if things are getting a little bit wonky, your mood ratings are dropping, your energy ratings are off, it gives you some data to then sort of look at what you might want to change in terms of your daily routine.
So this social rhythm metric is a core tool within interpersonal and social rhythm therapy, right? Am I understanding that correctly? Yeah,
it's our monitoring tool.
Did you say everything that you wanted to about interpersonal and social rhythm therapy as an intervention for bipolar disorder or a treatment approach? And, you know, how much data? Tell me about the science behind this as an intervention.
So originally, the intervention was interpersonal and social rhythm therapy. It was considered an adaptation of interpersonal psychotherapy, which is an evidence-based treatment for unipolar depression. And the very first study that was done at the University of Pittsburgh focused on individuals with bipolar 1 disorder and was actually a maintenance study. It sort of followed folks over 2 years and was able to show that getting the IPSRT intervention was associated with a decreased risk of having a mood episode over a 2-year follow-up period. There have been other studies looking at IPSRT as an acute treatment for depression in the context of bipolar disorder, showing a more rapid recovery from an acute depressive episode. We've also done some work in folks with bipolar 2 disorder, showing that we can use IPSRT in a small group of individuals with bipolar 2 disorder in the absence of medication to use these self-management strategies to recover from a bipolar depressive episode. And more recently, we've done some work using this as an intervention for youth and young adults. This is a work that I'm collaborating with Hilary Blumberg, who's at Yale University, to address suicide risk. So these are individuals with mixed mood disorders. And it seems that there's a specific effect on reducing risk for suicide. Those data are still pretty preliminary. We're in the middle of doing a couple of those trials. And we've also done it actually with some unipolar disorder as well, some folks with unipolar depression.
So really interesting and solid sounding evidence base. How many clinicians in North America or the United States are trained in this as a treatment approach for bipolar disorder? How have you helped facilitate access to this for patients?
Yeah, lots of folks will ask me about this. We have a free website. It was developed with funding from NIMH, where we looked at different ways to train therapists in IPSRT. And so the website is ipsrt.org, and there's a free online training there. It's targeting therapists who want to do the therapy. It's like an 8-hour course. But I've had lots of people living with bipolar disorder who've done it too. I mean, there's nothing, you know, you can do that and learn some self-management strategies as well, but that's not the intent of it. I mean, we've had hundreds of thousands of visitors. I don't have the number off the top of my head, who have completed that online course. We are working on developing a registry and don't have it. So I can't tell you how many people are trained in IPSRT, but what I usually tell people to do, if you're working with a therapist who's interested in this and wants to, you know, sort of help you, coach you through this, they're welcome to hop onto that website and do the IPSRT training online. I also have a book that's just been published, which is focusing on the social rhythm therapy part of it. And it's a self-help workbook. So it's targeting folks who want to work on their social rhythm more directly. And that can be used as an individual by themselves or in conjunction with, you know, a therapist who wants to sort of work collaboratively to go through some of these skills and provide some individual coaching. So I think there are a lot of options available to people who are interested in this approach, but you might need to do a little bit of legwork to make it happen.
And let's circle back a bit to the book, because that sounds fascinating, like a real important contribution. What was your motivation for creating something that was more patient-focused, focusing on people with lived experience of bipolar disorder? Was there a missing piece there in terms of tools that people could sort of incorporate into their daily lives? What was your motivation for actually writing the book in the first place?
Because people kept asking me, what can I do? Yeah, of course. So, you know, I mean, again, I do think these are very self-empowering strategies. And the end user is somebody with bipolar disorder. Although Philip Frank always says, this is what your grandmother would tell you to do. This is good for everybody with a brain. And I think that's true. So I think that we can all live more healthily if we have regular social rhythms. But if you're struggling and if you have bipolar disorder, you might need some additional help and strategies and practice to get there. And so I really wanted to create this workbook so that people would have a tool that they could use, whether or not they could access a therapist who is trained in this modality to work towards establishing more regular social rhythms. Because we know that this helps, that this works. And it all, you know, it always felt like it was something that we could do a better job of kind of getting out there and making sure that people had access to it if they wanted to work on it. And so, you know, that was the motivation for creating this workbook, kind of do a brain dump and kind of get it out there so people can use it if they want to.
Thanks for sharing that. And congratulations on the publication of the book. We'll provide details of that in the show notes. Was there anything that we didn't get to in our time together that you wanted to circle back to or touch on? Did you get our main messages across, do you think?
I think so. The one thing that I would maybe just touch on, in SRT, we talk about striving for supra-normal routines.
Supra-normal.
So the idea here is that we're able to measure how regular, you know, sort of the routines are of a general population versus people who seem to do especially well with SRT or IPSRT. And the regularity of routines is more regular than, you know, just the average person without bipolar disorder walking down the street. And I often use the analogy of somebody with diabetes. So if you have that biologic vulnerability to insulin resistance, you're going to need to follow a diet that is like extra healthy, like more healthy than what a person who doesn't have that biologic vulnerability needs to follow. So, I mean, sugar is not really good for any of us, but if you have that biologic vulnerability to diabetes, you really have to be careful about your sugar intake, your carbohydrate intake. And so you're kind of having like a supra normal diet. I think the same thing is true for social rhythms and bipolar disorder. So if you have that biologic vulnerability to circadian dysregulation, then it does seem like we need to have an extra normal set of routines. So to being even more consistent about wake time, sleep time, meal times, activities than somebody who doesn't have that biologic vulnerability to circadian disruption. And so I think going into this with that mindset that, you know, what we're striving for is supra normal rhythms, I think it's just helpful to sort of think about that from the outset.
Yeah. And I appreciated the way as well that you kind of normalized that and that, you know, we all have vulnerabilities in aspects of our health or mental health, and we all need to spend a little bit of extra time or pay a little bit of extra attention to certain areas of our life to flourish and live our optimal, healthy lives. And that's quite a normal process for everybody. And for people with bipolar disorder, this focus on routines, maybe one of those aspects that needs a little bit of extra TLC, tender loving care and attention over time.
I think these are things that are helpful to everybody. And again, you know, getting back to the message of engaging a support system, you know, something that everyone can feel healthier if they do in their daily lives.
Been wonderful to have this time with you today, Holly. Thank you so much for everything you've shared with us and with our listeners. And I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been such a pleasure.